Marketplace is produced in association with the University of Southern California.
Hey, when an earthquake hits close to a magnitude 6 here on the West Coast, we check our watches and maybe how much the light fixtures are swaying, and then we go back to work. But when the ground shakes from Virginia all the way to the Great Lakes and Rhode Island, the disruption can be more widespread. From American Public Media, this is Marketplace.
Investing, renting, sending your kid to college? Listen to the Marketplace Money Podcast. Find it on iTunes or at marketplace.org/podcasts.
From the Frank Stanton Studios in Los Angeles, good day to you. I'm Bob Moon in for Kai Rizdahl. Thanks for joining us this Tuesday, the 23rd of August. Okay, so maybe it wasn't really all that earth-shaking, especially for those of us perhaps a bit more jaded out here on the left coast. Still, today's magnitude 5.8 shaker across the Northeast did cause air and rail travel delays, a precautionary shutdown of some nuclear power plants, and it emptied out office buildings from New York to Washington right in the middle of the workday. There was widespread but mostly minor damage. We think it was only coincidence, but at just about the same time, Bank of America's stock seemed to halt its seemingly relentless fall. Well, for a while, anyway. Maybe investors got distracted. They've been shaken enough as it is, watching B of A shares swing to extreme lows all year. Even as bank profits have been on the rise in general, B of A shares keep sliding, another 2% today. Here's our New York Bureau Chief, Heidi Moore.
Back in 2008, Charles Elson predicted trouble when Bank of America bought mortgage lender Countrywide and investment bank Merrill Lynch. Now Elson, a professor at the University of Delaware, can say he told you so.
I think that when they absorbed Countrywide, they ended up taking on a lot more than they had expected. And obviously, they are now paying for that today.
Bank of America's bill for bad Countrywide mortgages is already in the billions. Chris Whalen, a prominent bank analyst, says the estimate of the final damage could be stratospheric as new lawsuits pile up.
You're talking well over $100 billion, conservatively. They could still win most of those cases and be in bad shape.
Whalen says investors don't believe Bank of America knows the full extent of its own problems. That's why the bank's stock has fallen 50% this year. But even though the markets keep slamming Bank of America, none of its troubles are exactly breaking news. The bank says the criticism is overblown. Elson believes Bank of America has become a lightning rod for the entire housing crisis.
Nothing new has come out of that bank in several weeks. I think it's a little unfair to penalize one institution for what, frankly, all the institutions were doing.
Some say that Bank of America's travails today are similar to what Citigroup went through in 2008. Citigroup was saved by two government bailouts. If Bank of America needs cash, it can't call on Uncle Sam. In New York, I'm Heidi Moore for Marketplace.
One of the credit rating agencies that helped get B of A in trouble, Standard & Poor's, has found itself in some hot water of its own lately. First, for being the only one of its peers to downgrade U.S. government bonds. And it's become the target of a federal investigation into whether the ratings on toxic mortgage bonds were wildly inflated. Today, S&P announced a new president will take over the firm in a few weeks. And while it denies there's any tie to the downgrade controversy or the investigation, S&P certainly has some credibility building ahead in Washington. Here's our D.C. Bureau Chief, John Dimsdale.
Devin Sharma became president of S&P in late 2007, just as the company was downgrading the prime ratings it had given bonds backed by subprime mortgages.
So in times of loss of confidence, they seem to tilt towards changing management.
Joshua Rossner follows S&P for Graham Fisher Investment Research. He figures Sharma's replacement has a mandate to fix S&P's image.
That was what Sharma was brought in to do, was to repair investor confidence, repair confidence in the Beltway of Washington. And frankly, I think confidence in S&P is no better than it was in 2007 when he came in.
S&P downgraded Treasury bonds even after the government accused the company of a $2 trillion accounting mistake. Its methodology was criticized by no less than the president and the Treasury secretary. Middlebury College economics professor Michael Schozer says S&P failed to convince Washington the downgrade was fair.
There should be a great deal of consistency between the way in which they rate the United States, the way they rate France, the way they rate Spain, other major countries.
The best way to shore up S&P's credibility is to disclose how it comes up with its grades, says Noel Hebert at Mitsubishi UFJ Securities.
the end of the day, you've got to look to the leader of the organization to be responsible for high-level communications.
Hebert says the White House and Congress were caught by surprise by S&P's downgrade. He says the new president, Douglas Peterson, will have to make sure that doesn't happen again. In Washington, I'm John Dimsdale for Marketplace.
Rebels continued making inroads in Libya today. Opposition fighters now control Muammar Gaddafi's compound and expect the country will be liberated within 72 hours. But the end of the Gaddafi regime doesn't mean the oil pipes will just be turned back on. Marketplace's Adrian Hill reports.
Selling oil requires more than just having oil. You can't just dig a hole in the ground and charge $80 a barrel. You need big equipment and pipes and roads and ports. And in Libya?
I think we simply have no idea what the scale of the damage is.
Syed Hirsch is a Middle East economist at Capital Economics in London.
We don't even know if the regime has any more fight in it and whether it will damage more of the oil infrastructure before it actually leaves.
Hirsch expects that the transitional government and foreign oil companies invested in the region will pay for the rebuilding. He doesn't expect too much to change in how oil is produced in Libya, but thinks the government will spend more oil money in country.
To actually pacify the different interest groups and the tribes in the country, it will have to make them feel wealthier.
Jeff Porter from North Africa Risk Consulting says the Transitional National Council, or TNC, has promised to honor all contracts with foreign oil companies. But
that doesn't necessarily mean that the TNC is going to be the permanent government of Libya in the next 2 or 3 years.
And a new government could try to change those agreements.
When new governments come in, they tend to reevaluate pre-existing contracts and try to extract more revenue for the state from those contracts.
So even though the political future of Libya seems close to some sort of certainty, the future of its oil industry is far from settled. I'm Adrian Hill for Marketplace.
Wall Street got all rosy again today. Details when we do the numbers. Last week, in kicking off our special coverage, The Breakdown, Our Economy One Step at a Time, we were looking for a name, a definition for our current economic situation. Investment banker and Lords of Finance author Liaquat Ahmed called it a debt overhang, and it's hanging over individuals and countries all over, including our own. So how do we deal with it? To explore that question, we've brought in financial expert John Malden. His latest book is Endgame, The End of the Debt Supercycle, and How It Changes Everything. Good to have you with us.
Hey, it's always good to be with you guys.
As individuals, we're still looking at mountains of debt. Same goes for the U.S. and nations all over Europe. So where do we go from here? What can we do about it?
The good news is that we're going to get through all this. The bad news is that it'll take 5 to 6 years. We're in a different type of economic environment. We're coming to the end of individuals being able to borrow. We're seeing that. And now we're coming to the end of governments being able to borrow. And we're at a place where we're going to have to drop about $150 billion a year, 200, you know, pick a number, of deficit over the next 10 years. We can't do it all at once, and we get through it.
You know, not too long ago, I had the chance to sit down with a great uncle of mine and hear his tales of growing up in the years out of the Great Depression. And I was struck by the fact that that was the whole of his formative years. The entire family just lived from one job to the next for years and years. Are the Americans struggling to find work today in that kind of cycle now?
I'm actually afraid so. I have 7 kids from 34 to 17. 6 of them are out in the real world now, married, grandkids. And they're struggling to find good-paying jobs. Some of them are struggling to find paying jobs at all. Mm. There is one group in the United States that has seen their employment rate rise, the 55 and up group. We're all working longer. Older people who are recognizing their paychecks, their retirement plans, aren't going to be able to get them to retire, and they're going back to work. They've got a lot to offer. They're diligent. They get up in the morning. You don't have to worry about them being hungover, and people are hiring them.
So is this just the new reality then? Everyone cutting back, watching pennies, working longer? For how long?
5 to 6 years. That's how long it will take us to get our deficit down below the growth rate of our economy.
Is there not a more immediate approach, though? Last week we had a guest, an investment banker, who said that banks might just have to write down something of this debt. What do you think?
Well, banks will have to write down a lot. They have already written down a lot. I mean, the Austrian economic school, the von Mises and the Hayeks of the world, would say, let's have this one big cathartic event where we just write down everything. We take it all down to zero. Our houses drop another 20%. Stock market falls out of bed and we have a depression. And then we can start coming out of the depression. And that worked, by the way, for Iceland. However, I don't know that I want to go through 20% unemployment and the pain of that. I think I'd rather take my pain in measured portions over the next 5 or 6 years.
How quickly does something need to be done for us to start that 5-year recovery cycle that you're talking about?
I think the markets will let us slide through the beginning, the middle of 2014. They're going to want to see whatever new administration comes in or old or whatever the new government in 2013. They're going to want to see a really credible plan that says we're going to attack the deficit by reducing it over time. And, you know, I'm a card-carrying Republican, but as a businessman, I would rather see some combination of lots of spending cuts and lots of reorganization of government, along with, if we have to, tax increases in order to keep the system going. I want an environment where I can see some certainty, I can make some plans, and I can look into the future with some degree of comfort saying, I can see where we're going.
John Malden is author of Endgame, The End of the Debt Supercycle and How It Changes Everything. Thanks for joining us.
It's good to be with you, Bob.
Continuing a theme all this week, it's a bittersweet back-to-school time for the country's largest public university. At Arizona State, like too many other schools, the axe has fallen on more than 1,000 jobs at ASU since the financial crisis began. KJZZ's Peter O'Dowd takes a look at how budget cuts and layoffs aren't so academic for some workers.
In the 11 years that Beatrice Roman worked at ASU, she waxed the floors and dusted the insides of 5 buildings. She even knew exactly how much toilet paper each building needed, 8 rolls for every floor. Then, at the very end of last school year,
the lady, she's come, and she said, oh, I have bad news.
That lady was an ASU administrator.
Everybody lose the job. Everybody's working only 2 more weeks.
The university laid off its entire custodial staff. All 191 people were offered jobs with private companies that would take over ASU's cleaning duties.
After this, I'm going to be depressed, really, really be depressed.
Roman is a widow and the mother of a teenager, but she turned down the offer. In fact, only 3 people took the job. Custodians say the pay and vacation days were less. Health insurance premiums were more expensive. Plus, there were no state retirement benefits, and if Roman accepted the work, she'd lose her university severance package. That pays $1,100 a month, the same as her previous salary after taxes. With a pet parakeet chirping behind her, I ask what happens when the money runs out in November.
Good question. Good question. I need a phone job soon.
A summer break has passed since the layoffs. Now more than 70,000 students are returning to a university that has changed a lot in recent years.
It hit our department particularly strongly.
Ryan Stotts is an anthropology graduate student.
We all had formed a relationship with Beatrice and felt that she was somebody that we were going to miss and somebody that we needed to help support.
31 professors from her school wrote to the president's office. The letter said terminating the most vulnerable people in low-paying jobs did not reflect ASU community values when those in higher-paying jobs were unaffected. Archaeology professor Ben Nelson.
People who are made to pay are people who don't have a lot of voice. If we want to think of the university as kind of a microcosm of society or the way we would like society to be, then this doesn't seem to fit the picture.
Nelson and others said they would have taken furlough days to save the custodians' jobs.
When you have a furlough, that's a temporary savings.
Chief Financial Officer Morgan Olson says since 2008, the university has endured $196 million in state budget cuts. At the same time, student enrollment has soared. In all, ASU laid off 1,300 people.
It's just implicit, inherent, that you're going to have some difficult decisions to make, and you can't continue to do everything you've always done in the way that you've previously done it.
Olson says ASU will likely avoid further job cuts this school year.
Hi, baby. Hi.
And if that's correct, Beatrice Roman was among the last to go. She left ASU with a pile of letters wishing her well and an extra $5,000 raised by professors and students. She'll use the money to catch up on several months of overdue mortgage payments.
Beautiful people. I love these persons a lot.
And that's why the start of the school year is so painful.
It's hard. It's duro.
It's hard to drive by campus, she says. Its buildings remind her of the people inside. In Tempe, Arizona, I'm Peter O'Dowd for Marketplace.
Coming up, the unintended consequences of medical technology.
I mean, there are over 160 million females missing from the population in Asia.
It's the latest installment of Freakonomics. But first, let's do the numbers. Shaking it up on Wall Street. The Dow Jones Industrial Average jumped 322 points, or 3%, to finish at 11,176. And that's after a 60-point decline in the Dow just after the East Coast earthquake. The NASDAQ rose 100 points, 4.3%, to end the day at 2446. The S&P 500 put on 38 points, 3.4%, to close at 1162. ExxonMobil pumped up 5%. Chevron added 4.3%. ConocoPhillips gained more than 3.5%. New home sales fell more than expected, and that knocked down home builders. PulteGroup crumbled 4%. KB Home lost nearly 3%. Besides Bank of America, financials were mostly big winners. Citigroup, Wells Fargo, and J.P. Morgan Chase all deposited gains of more than 4%. And you're listening to Marketplace.
Looking for a good read? Visit the Big Book blog at marketplace.org. Listen to author interviews and read excerpts from the Marketplace bookshelf. Online at marketplace.org/the Big Book.
From the Marketplace Datebook, here's a look at events coming up Wednesday. In Washington, the Commerce Department reports on durable goods orders for July. Are the kids working? The Labor Department releases 2011 summer youth labor force data. And you take the good, you take the bad, you take them both, and there you have the facts of life. It premiered August 24th, 1979. I'm Michelle Phillippe.
This is Marketplace from APM, American Public Media. I'm Bob Moon in for Kai Rizdahl. Maybe you'll recall that last year, Ticketmaster merged with concert promoter Live Nation. Antitrust lawyers at the Justice Department were worried the two would create a monopoly, so the feds mandated that Ticketmaster share its software until another ticket-selling site could launch. And today, launch it did. It's called Access, spelled A-X-S, and it's owned by AEG. The giant company owns concert and sports venues from L.A.'s Staples Center to London's O2 Arena. Here's Marketplace's Mitchell Hartman.
Among the first tickets to be sold on Access will be a Denver show by punk band Social Distortion. The group's angry lyrics could just as well be about buying concert tickets these days. There's got to be another way. Take away. Unschutz Entertainment Group, which owns Access, thinks its new ticket service is that better way. The service lets you buy tickets at the theater or arena's own website rather than linking you to a ticket website like Ticketmaster. And it shows all the fees up front, says Gary Bongiovanni of the concert trade magazine Polestar.
They're not going to charge the much-hated print-at-home fee that no one could ever really understand why that fee was even there in the first place. And then that is part of what generated so much ill will against Ticketmaster.
Ever since Ticketmaster's merger with Live Nation last year, David Wertheimer has been waiting for a worthy opponent to show up. Wertheimer runs the Entertainment Technology Center at USC.
This
deal represents competition, and competition is good. It's good for the venues. It's good for the artists and the teams. And, you know, it's just good to have choice in the marketplace.
According to numbers from Pollstar, ticket sales have been down in the recession, even as prices have been trimmed to bring in more fans. David Wertheimer says more competition may help revive the business. I'm Mitchell Hartman for Marketplace.
It's Freakonomics time. It's that time every couple of weeks here on Marketplace when we explore the hidden side of everything. Today, when a new technology is unveiled, sometimes the unexpected comes along too. Here's Stephen Dubner.
One day, during a reporting trip to Anhui Province in China, the journalist Mara Vistendahl visited a family planning office. She saw something strange.
They showed me to the room in their office where the ultrasound machines kept, and they had actually installed two locks on the door.
It was kept under lock and key because...
In some countries where sex selection has taken off, people see this machine as really a way to ensure them a boy.
Since the introduction of the ultrasound in Asia in the early 1980s, it's often been used to determine the gender of a fetus and, if it's female... have an abortion. In a part of the world with big populations, these sex-selective abortions have had a big unintended consequence.
I mean, there are over 160 million females missing from the population in Asia. To put that in perspective, it's more than the entire female population of the United States.
So what happens in a world with too many men? For starters, there's more sex trafficking, more AIDS, a higher crime rate. In fact, if you want to know the crime rate in a given part of India, one surefire indicator is the gender ratio. The more men, the more crime. Now, the ultrasound machine didn't create these problems, but it did enable them. So you have to wonder, what's next?
With a blood test where blood's drawn from the arm, it's zero risk for the baby and essentially zero for the mom.
That's Stephen Quake. He's a biophysicist at Stanford. He has developed a new blood test that will screen for genetic abnormalities like Down syndrome in a fetus. Now, it's typically done now by amniocentesis, which requires sticking a big needle through a woman's abdomen, through the uterus, and into the amniotic sac. A blood test would do away with a lot of that risk, the invasiveness, and the cost, and it would give parents information earlier in a pregnancy.
The overall goal here, I think, is to lower stress. Impending parenthood is a very stressful time.
If more people opt for Quake's blood test, then more people will find out earlier that they have a fetus with a genetic abnormality. So, would we see the end of Down syndrome births? Here's my Freakonomics co-author, economist Steve Levitt.
There are many people now who are willing to put in God's hands whether or not they have a Down syndrome child. And I think those are the kind of parents who, if they have a Down syndrome child, will give loving and supportive households. And then there's a set of parents who desperately want to avoid having a Down syndrome child, who cannot handle financially or psychologically the cost that would come with it.
In other words, just because there's an easier test doesn't mean everyone will want to use it. Levitt, being an economist, doesn't see the situation as simply a moral decision. He sees it as a sorting mechanism.
In a world in which there are two different kinds of people, some who welcome Down syndrome children and some who don't, it seems to me that if you have a cheap, easy, safe, reliable test, that's a perfect sorting mechanism to ensure that, in some sense, the right Down syndrome children get born.
Dr. Quake's blood test is in clinical trials now and maybe on the market this year. So we'll start to see the outcome sooner rather than later. What'll it be? It's hard to say. The future is the future. But don't be surprised if we turn out to be surprised. There are a lot of powerful laws in the universe, but the law of unintended consequences may be one of the most powerful. I'm Stephen Dubner for Marketplace.
Stephen, Mr. Dubner is our Freakonomics correspondent. He's also the co-author of the books and blog by the same name. You can catch his podcast on iTunes and hear more at freakonomicsradio.com.
Freakonomics Radio is supported by Reputation.com, helping small business owners, professionals, and executives monitor, protect, and improve their online reputations. Reputation.com. Marketplace is produced in association with the University of Southern California's Marshall School of Business.
A final note, coffee prices have been percolating up for almost a year and a half now, but it looks like the cost of your morning brew might have reached its peak. Today, Kraft Foods dropped the list price of its flagship Maxwell House brand by roughly 6%. That follows last week's price cut for most coffee brands sold by Smucker's, including its flagship Folgers. We'll do the math for you. You should be paying about 20 cents a pound less for ground coffee, or a couple of pennies per ounce off instant. And that's Marketplace from APM, American Public Media. Today, the Dow jumped 322 points, or 3%. The Nasdaq rose 100 points, 4.3%. And the S&P 500 put on 38 points, 3.4%. Thanks to Ethan Lindsay and Jolie Podokas on our Morning Report crew. The Marketplace Morning Report is produced by Rod Abeed. And that's where you can turn for the latest in Breakdown, our coverage of the economy one step at a time. Next time on this program, want a job in this new economy that still pays six figures?
Our economy would collapse and no longer cease to function if we didn't have oil, so I'm willing to be the dirty person who has to get the job done.
Yeah, I should have majored in petroleum engineering. I'm Bob Moon. Hope you can join us for that tomorrow. This is APM, American Public Media.
Oscar Gomez was a Chicano student activist in the 90s, a radio DJ, and a rising star.
He was fire. He was charisma incarnate. Everyone had a crush on him.
He was a voice of people who didn't have a voice.
Until his sudden and mysterious death. What happened to Oscar? Imperfect Paradise, The Forgotten Revolutionary, wherever you get your podcasts.